This podcast is proudly sponsored by Yukonuba Sporting Dog. If you want to get everything your dog's got, you need nutrition that holds nothing back. To help unleash your dog's maximum potential, check out the new Yukonuba Premium Performance lineup at yukonubasportingdog.com.
Welcome to a new episode of Operation Gundog. We hope you enjoy it. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. With us today, we have Grayson Geyer from Lost Highway Gun Dogs. He's going to be talking with us about some specific tests that you can run with your pointing dogs and some tests that he participates in. I know last episode we went into Upland Hunter, UKC, HRC episode, and so we kind of wanted to dive off into a little more pointing type tests. And so we have with us Grayson. Grayson, why don't you give us a little background on yourself and talk to us a little bit about what you're doing at Lost Highway Gun Dogs.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah. My name is Grayson Geyer. I live in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, on a farm that's been provided to me by a benefactor, luckily, and I operate my kennel here, which is Lost Highway Kennels, Lost Highway Gun Dog Kennels. Been training professionally on and off for nearly 20 years with some relatively significant breaks to try other means of making a living. But certainly as a hobbyist and, really somebody that's been ate up with training dogs in general, pretty much my entire adult life. So I was lucky to grow up around some guys that were really into bird dogs and hunting and some good trainers that exposed me to this at an early age. But I really really found my passion for training in working dogs after my time in the military. And so I spent a lot of time training in the sport of Schutzhund and another sport called PSA. And, I had some Malinois and German Shepherds and things of that nature. And have kind of, I guess, pretty much retired from that. It's a young man's game. So now after some time contracting for the military, I've kind of resign myself to gun dogs, in general gun dogs. I still train quite a few retrievers and some spaniels here and there, but most of my work centers around pointing breeds and versatile gun dog work.
Awesome. So that's something that we definitely want to hear about, and I definitely have an interest in. So what type of testing do you participate with your dogs?
Mostly I participate in a trial system, that's sanctioned by the United Kennel Club, the UKC, and it's their, what they call the UKC pointing dog program. And it's modeled on FCI field trials. So, that's the European kind of overarching governing kennel club, for mostly continental Europe, but there's other countries that are participants or constituents of the FCI in other parts of the world. Argentina, I know, is one, I believe there's maybe an Asian country or two in there. But when most people think of the FCI, they think of the European continent, and when you think of field trialing over there with pointing dogs, it's broken normally into two categories. You have the British breeds that mostly compete amongst themselves, and then you have the continental breeds. And so personally, my hobby breed is are Brittany's, of European descent, so often known colloquially here as French Brittany's, but in their country of origin, France, they call them Epagnol Breton. And so those are the dogs I play with, and We have a very active club that hosts quite a few trials across the country every year. And the good thing about the UKC Pointing Dog program is there's different levels of competition within the program. So we have two classes. One is the gun dog class, and that's for more folks that aren't necessarily interested in breaking their dog out, study to wing shot and fall and retrieving on command. It's more of what you would think of as a hunting dog. So the judgment of steadiness is going to stop at the flush of the bird. And the birds are shot on the course. It's a forward course, and the birds are expected to be retrieved on the course, you know, by the dog to the handler. And then we have an open class, which is a completely broke class, where the dog is expected to be steady to wing shot and fall, and retrieve on command. And so there's judged as a competition. So we have winners, but also there is an element of pass fail. So your dog may not go out there and be the most competitive dog on the course, but there's still opportunities to title. So it's a very kind of competitor friendly game, friendly to newcomers. And, you know, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fellowship, and it's something I personally would love to see that program grow. I had a lot of fun doing it, and, you know, it's open to all breeds. And so would certainly suggest that anybody that hasn't heard of that and has any passing interest in pointing breeds at all, has ever considered field trialing, this is a great way to get into that world, you know? So, but also in addition to that, I have recently become involved in the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association, which is also known as NAVDA, which is essentially an Americanized or a North Americanized version of the German testing system, and I believe, and I would never know what the abbreviation for is over there, but it's, I believe, the JHVG, and that's and so in Germany, every dog that's going to be bred is expected to test to a specific standard, in order to be qualified as a breeding dog. And so I believe in the 60s, a gentleman by the name of Bodo Vinterhelt came to this country, and he had poodle pointers, and he kind of brought this system with him and planted a seed that's really turned into an exceptionally strong organization in this country. And I would say NAVDA is doing great. You know, when a lot of the games we play are not doing so well, and especially hunting in general is losing participation every year, NAVDA, it's an organization, is very, very strong. And so, and they do a great job of really home growing participants and providing a support network for newcomers to hunting and pointing dogs in general. So another organization I highly recommend looking into to folks that may not be familiar with it.
So, you know, it's really neat hearing you talk about that UKC pointing dog testing system, and how you have the gun dogs in the open. And is there some sort of check and balance in place to keep an open level dog from, you know, placing first over and over and over again in the gun dog category?
Not necessarily. I mean, you could compete in the gun dog category. They're really two separate things. So when you're it's a baseline level of training. And so essentially, you know, there are plenty of gun dogs that if I'm judging them to the gun dog standard, are more than capable of beating some fantastic open class dogs, because the judgment is just simply easier. What I'm looking for always when I'm judging a field trial, and I judge quite a few every year, you know, my number one criteria is what dog out here would I most like to put in my truck and take home with me. And there are plenty of dogs that may not have received a certain level of training, but have a real natural power and presence. And so I see a ton of dogs in the gun class that maybe are not quite as polished as open class dogs, but what I see of in them in terms of potential, genetically may far exceed anything I saw in the gun dog or the open course that day. It's essentially just a matter of, if you were looking at derbies, and you may have a, retriever, that is a qualified all age dog. If you run them in a derby and the judge is being objective, in my opinion, I'd be looking for the dog. Obviously, you need a baseline level of training, but I'm looking for a dog that wows me, if that makes sense. So, if it, just because a dog can go out there and take literal casts and do it clean and get through the series with fewer whistles than the next dog, doesn't mean he's carrying some sort of power and style that the next dog may, if that makes sense.
I think that makes perfect sense, and sounds like you're looking for the it factor. And with that type of test, we'll use a derby for an example. You do kind of level the playing field. It doesn't, and in the derbies, it doesn't matter how really much training or how far they've gotten in training, as far as like running blinds and casting and stuff like that. Whenever at the end of the day, it's more of a natural marking test. Of course, it does take, some
Sure.
preparing for the distances, but
Yeah.
I definitely get what you're saying.
Well, that's
And I
right.
think it
And
relates well.
yeah, and a 13-month-old dog that comes out there and, front foot's a big long mark and does it with a cracking tail and going just as hard on his way home as he does on his way out, that's what people are looking for at the Derby.
Right.
And yeah, you don't need to go out there and be as technically proficient as a dog that's going to go, run at the next level. So same idea.
Right. So another thing that you mentioned that I really like the idea of is kind of adopting I guess the field trials or the tests from FCI or from Europe. And I think that's great that something's happening kind of in the pointer world. It makes me kind of wish that the British retriever trials had kind of made a I guess a bigger showing over here, up to this point. They might have some smaller stuff going on, but not a lot that I really come across. But I think it's pretty cool that, both sides of the pond could be doing, very similar testing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I think what I see out of, in our game is we have some American bred dogs and we have pointers and setters that have come over and competed with us. And, a good dog's a good dog, and it really shows up if if a big, hard running American bred, all age type horseback field trial dog can come over and run a tight course on foot with me judging and still handle like one of our dogs. That says a lot. It says as much as one of our dogs going and competing in their game, in my opinion. And I think there's a lot less variation than obviously we're looking for a specific set of criteria when we breed, so when we discuss maybe British labs versus American labs, there's certain things we're looking for that that may be considered intangibles in the field, right? In terms of their general demeanor or their temperament. But when it comes to a working test, a mark is a mark, or and
Right.
and things of that nature. So what I want to see is if I'm looking at if I'm measuring a British lab against an American lab, I could care less about where that dog comes from if he's showing me the performance in the field. Now, do I want to carry him home and deal with him? That's a different story sometimes, but if the performance in the field is certainly it's an objective standard that can be met anywhere, and I think it's a lot of fun. I would love to see some British style trials too. That's a subject that's near and dear to my heart. I've got a great friend up here that's a Brit and has some fantastic dogs, and I spend a lot of time training with him, and I've learned a lot from him and learned how to certainly, you know, broaden my skill set if I had was limited in my use of tools for sure.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about the different types of retriever trials and which one is most closely resembling like an actual hunt. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the British style trials, it is an actual hunt, and you're actually, there's not planted birds. You're going and, you know, kind of shooting what comes up, you know, sending your dog.
And imagine, it must be a lot more work for the judges too. You know, you think about a walked up day, and you know, if you go to an American trial or hunt test, you know, each dog is essentially going to seem the same setup, you know, and I love the idea that, like you said, I mean, you might cripple a pheasant that runs, got who knows how far, you know, with the wind on his back, and that dog has to show a skill set that you know, is maybe beyond anything another dog might see all day. But if he does that, he gets the opportunity to shine there and do something very special, you know, or he doesn't, and he gets picked up and the dog behind him comes and wipes his eye, and he gets that opportunity to shine on something very unique and special and hard or challenging, you know, and
right.
I think that's super cool. And, you know, I would love to see more of that in this country.
It's right. It's really neat. Like you said, a lot of the tests that we've talked about here and the tests that me and John have run personally, their goal is for the test to be as standard across all dogs that day as possible, down to, you know, using electronic duck calls and primers on launchers and stuff like that. So everything sounds the same, the timing's the same, each dog sees the mark in the exact same spot. And really the only variable that we see in some of these hunt tests is when a flyer gets shot, they don't always land in the same spot. So like you said, it's unique. And I feel like it would pose an even bigger challenge to training, because if you know, all right, I might go out there and we'll, you know, jump a pheasant within the first two steps we take into the field, versus, all right, we're going to have to walk around a little bit. Like you said, you wing a bird and it keeps running. Like, I feel like you really have to show your dog even a wider scope of things in training than you do, you know, say training for a junior or a started hunt test.
Yeah, 100%. I think, yeah, I mean, I think objective standards are important. I love hunt tests. I love the idea of hunt tests. Personally, I like competing too. And I think, you know, competition gives you the opportunity to maybe allow for a little less objectivity in the setup. Now, I mean, it's tougher in American field trials because of the way the series are run, and, you know, dogs are eliminated as you go forward. You know, but especially the way the Brits do it, I think is super cool, because it's not as if it's unfair. If the dog doesn't make it, you know, it's another dog is required to perform that challenging, you know, scenario before you can eliminate your dog. You know what I mean? And the dog that comes up behind it has to do it in order for your dog to be eliminated. Otherwise, it just goes as maybe something that was no dog was capable of that day, and nobody's eliminated. And I think that's I like that. I think it's a fair way of doing it. I think it's a neat way of allowing for unique setups within a trial.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're running dogs, it's the same thing. Like, you never know. You don't know what birds are going to do on the ground, even if they're planted, you know, and the wind's going to shift, or it's going to die, or conditions are going to change between each dog finding something. So that you can't maintain. And it's really hard on a forward course and a technical course to maintain an objective standard in a pointing dog field trial. So that's why, you know, I think the competitive nature of trialing kind of lends itself to pointing dogs a little better, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned those two different rigors of those pointing breed test with UKC, and you have that gun dog, and you have the open. What are some of the key factors they're looking for? Like you said, gun dog, they're not so much looking for that steadiness at a wing shot fall, but open they might be. What are some more things they're looking for? Like, are you grading on marking ability? Are you grading on, you know, how well they hold the point? What are the criteria they're looking for in gun dog, and what are some of the criteria they're looking for in open?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, we have in both classes, we're going to have a set of objective standards, and you must, you know, each dog must meet the minimum criteria to pass. So we can award a pass. And those are going to be things like, you know, steadiness, you know, search. Is the dog covering the ground? You know, what we would call a ground race. Is he covering efficiently and effectively? You know, an experienced dog will understand how to use the wind to his advantage. He'll be on the leeward side of cover, you know, and as he quests for the bird. You know, does he handle? Is he cooperating for his handler? Is the handler, you know, and that so much of this is the nuance of handling a dog, you know, handling a dog without making it look like you're handling the dog, right? Putting as little effort as possible into it and getting the maximum effect. And so, you know, we want to see bold, confident ground application. You know, the dog is using the ground and the cover efficiently. He's using the wind efficiently and effectively. And then once he makes game, he has appropriate manners. Right. So he's not, you know, once he makes game, he goes on point and he doesn't disturb the bird. He doesn't push it up. He doesn't, you know, he waits for the guns to get there in the case of the gun class. And once the bird moves on the ground, as a judge, we can consider that part of the flush. So if the dog breaks, right, as the bird's on the ground, objectively, I can say, hey, this dog was steady to the minimum criteria. You know, what I'd prefer to see is even if that bird runs on the ground and tempts that dog, that he stays steady or staunch until the bird get in the air. And I'd really prefer to see one of the guns take a shot and knock that bird down before that dog breaks and runs for it. Now, that said, I'm not going to hold, I may not, it's not a requirement for me in order to give that dog a placement in the competitive side of that trial that he do that, as long as he's wowed me in other ways. But if he wows me in other ways and he shows me those kind of manners in the gun class, you know, I'm certainly going to put him in contention or her in contention for a placement. And the next dog is going to have to be at least that good to beat him, you know, and show me something and wow me in another place. And for the open class, it's just simply the rules just get a little more stringent, which is now you're not, I don't want to see you take a step. That bird's going to be in the air. The guy's going to shoot it. It's going to fall to the ground. There may be two dogs on the course, one honoring and one, you know, the pointing dog. And the honoring dog's going to have to stand there and honor as the other dog is sent for that retrieve. You know, and the less the handler has to toil to get that done, the more casual he can be and the stronger the character the dog shows in that work, you know, the better he's or she's going to look, you know. And so you know, it's hard to get a dog, or what we call getting a dog around the course clean in a field trial is like you get through the whole course that you're to run and you haven't had any real flubs, you know, but I do have, you know, disqualifying errors that dogs may commit. And most times I'll just have the handler pick that dog up in the open class because folks running in the open class, we kind of expect to be held to a little higher standard. If they're in the gun class, even if they've had a disqualifying foul, I may decide to leave those people down for the experience, you know, and I usually explain to them that, hey, you know, I can't give you a pass or a placement here, but I'm enjoying watching your dog. And I think your dog's getting something out of this and I'd like for you to continue. So, you know, I mean, those are essentially, that's it. I mean, we're, you know, the standard is the standard. You must meet it. But in order to win, you know, go out there and show me something special. And that's, you know, that's the intangible.
The it factor, like John said.
That's it.
With honoring, with pointing breeds, is the honor dog walking on heel next to its handler, or does that dog have to back the pointing dog on the field? What is honoring in a pointing dog test?
So honoring for pointing dogs is done independent of the handler. So if one dog goes on point, I have one dog pointing, upon seeing that dog on point, his brace mate should stop and either what we call back or honor that pointing dog by proceeding no further in order to not interfere with the pointing dog and his bird. And so, especially if you're hunting thick cover or big country or whatever, it's helpful if you've got multiple dogs on the ground. When one sees one on point, that they stop, and oftentimes you'll see the honoring dog, and as you get closer, you'll see the pointing dog somewhere in thick cover. So, but that's the idea. Is it's a what we would consider appropriate manners around birds for a bird dog, and that comes. There's some tradition to that that's just, maybe not what you would consider necessary in a meat dog, but if you're usually it's if you're going to drop your dog with your part with your buddy's dog, for me personally, I want to make sure my dog's at least trained to the level of my buddy's dog, so that I'm not messing his bird work up that day, and so. The backing is, it's a natural behavior oftentimes. But for me personally, if it's not reinforced appropriately, then it'll fail you when you need it. So.
So is that test designed so that you can be explicit on which dog is the honor dog, or is it you're just kind of running two dogs simultaneously and whichever one finds a bird first is the point dog and the other one has to be honor?
Yep. So it's, yeah, I mean, we go out and we hunt. So in field trials, we don't contrive the setups, other than the fact that if we're running on liberated birds, we're gonna make sure the field's planted and has enough birds for the dogs to find. We just cut those dogs loose and we go hunting. And and whatever happens in the field is what happens in the field. And so whatever dog finds that bird first is gonna go on point. And if the honoring dog happens to come upon him and honor, that looks good on the honoring dog. It's not a ding that the other dog found that bird first necessarily. It's giving that honoring dog an opportunity to show off and back his brace mate. Now, if one of those dogs is finding all the birds on the course and the other one's always honoring, that's going to say something about how intrepid one of the dogs is versus the other, and maybe his nose is better, or maybe he's just a better hunting dog in general. So you don't always want to be the honoring dog, but to know that you have a back here and there's nothing wrong with that,
That's really interesting. I think it's neat to look at a world like your UKC and AKC retriever tests that are very deliberate in the way the setups are, and then kind of come over to your pointer field trials, and it's almost I don't know if chaotic's the right word, but it's like you said, it's very liberating. It's very free for those dogs to perform like they're meant to do.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely, it's a different game. I mean, it's hard to, it's hard to observe retrievers doing the things they're doing, in a testing environment or a training environment if you were just out hunting. I mean, we all know good dog work when we see it, but if you're gonna test one dog on a standard and do each dog, you have to make it fair, and it's easier to do with pointing dogs because when really the rubber meets the road when the bird contact happens, and we don't have to worry about too much of the stuff that happens between turning them loose and finding the bird,
Yeah, it's for retrievers, could you imagine going on an actual duck hunt with like 12 dogs on your truck and you had to pick up a duck and then go grab another one?
Yeah, not too many, yeah, I don't know too many duck hunters that would like be willing to have a field trial in the middle of their duck hunt, a while.
So That brought up another point, you know, how true it is to the actual, you know, to an actual hunt is, you know, the planted birds are, they're not held in a box. Like, you know, one of the more recent episodes we talked about was HRC Upland Hunter, which is a little more controlled, and the birds are released from a box where, you know, when you mentioned planted, I just want to kind of distinguish the difference. That means that, you know, birds are planted in the field and are, you know, moving around.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, and I mean, honestly, the best trials, the birds are barely going to be planted. They're just, you know, guys that really know how to plant for a field trial, in my opinion, they're just going to run around on a four-wheeler and just throw birds down and kind of let them. You're not trying to stuff them under a piece of cover and keep them still. You really want those bird contacts. And you're hoping you have good hard-flying birds, you know. And this is what we would call a throwdown trial. Right. We do have field trials on wild birds as well. We don't shoot those birds during the wild trials. We only use manufactured barrels on blank guns. So, you know, but I would say in the UKC, you're looking at probably 33% wild bird trials and 66% liberated or planted bird trials, their throwdown trials, you know. But it's nice to have those wild bird trials, and I think a good pin raised bird is not a bird dog is not necessarily a good wild bird dog. But also the opposite holds true. A lot of folks don't realize to make a really good dog or a really good bird dog on pin raised birds is often much harder than making a good wild bird dog.
So you mentioned with the wild field trials, you're using blanks. So does that mean the dog doesn't get a retrieve?
Correct. Yeah. So we're not going to, you know, I mean, it's from a conservation standpoint, we don't consider it quite kosher to go out and shoot birds in the name of sport for the field trial. Gotcha. That's probably been the case since early conservation times. You know, back in the 19th century, they would do it for trialing. But a lot of our field trials are going to be held outside of your wild bird hunting seasons. But you know, wild birds, especially in the Southeast, I mean, they're a precious, precious resource.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we don't want to kill one on occasion. You know, it's just, you know, if you, you know, we host a couple of field trials a year on woodcock, and we don't want to carry everybody to our place right. And shoot our birds, right? You know, right. So, you know, it's just what it is. And we shoot on the course. We're only going to shoot pin raised birds.
I didn't know if there's like, you know, one of the guys walking out there or something has like a hip launcher or something. So, you know, the dog gets some sort of retrieve, but it's kind of interesting that they don't, because it's like, you know, you guys are focusing truly on the point, you know, that's the, what is a pointing dog? It's a dog that will slam on point, allow either a flushing dog or yourself to push a bird up and shoot it.
Sure.
So,
yeah. And so, you know, I mean, in different organizations are different, you know, I mean, so in the, as far as trialing organizations are concerned, the oldest in the country, really, I believe outside of the Kentucky Derby, the National Bird Dog Field Trial at Ames Plantation in Grand Junction, Tennessee, which is run by the Field Dog Stud Book, or the American Field, is, I believe, and I mean, I could be completely pulling this out of my hind end. I don't know, but I think it's the second oldest sporting event in the country, next to the Kentucky Derby. And so it's, but yeah, I mean, it's in the American Field, and in the AKC, even with the pin raised birds, they do not shoot the birds on the course for the most part. The dog is going to be judged steady to wing and shot. And that's going to be with a blank gun. So steady to wing and shot is going to be with a blank gun. And that's as far as the steadiness test is going to go for the most part. They're not going to drop the bird, and they're not going to require a retrieve. Now the AKC does have some retrieving stakes, and I believe they do have some shot birds on the course, but they got a mostly are going to be, you know, blanked off horsebacks type field trials, but they have a few of their own walking trials as well. Another trial organization is called NASTRA, which is, I believe, in, I'm going to mess this up, but I think it's the North American Shoot to Retrieve Association. So it's National Shoot to Retrieve Association, NSTRA, but also known as NASTRA for short. And that's a game that used to be sanctioned by the American Field, but because they shot birds on the course somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, they split because the American Field no longer wanted to carry the insurance required, as far as I know, to have birds shot on the course. And so NSTRA is still a very big game. It's a very well-run organization, and it's probably more popular than any of the horseback trial games. The real difference between it and the UKC gun dog class is that NASTRA is normally run in an open field that has kind of a boundary, in 30-minute braces that are timed with five birds on the course, and they've got a point system that goes along with that. And as far as the UKC pointing dog program is concerned, everything is on a forward course. Timing is less of an issue. The braces are 15-minute minimum, but we'll run them as long as we need to see what we want to see as the judges. And the number of contacts or the number of points that the dog has is really inconsequential, but they do need to demonstrate bird work in order to get a pass or a placement, if that makes sense. So those are kind of your trial games across the board. You have your big leagues, old school, which is really unfortunately kind of a dying game in this country, is the American Field all-age field trial has been going on in this country since the mid-1800s, and has a long storied heritage. They have a couple of walking trials that they do sanction, but they have bodies, so like U.S. Complete Shooting Dog Association, the North American Bird Hunters Association, I believe American Bird Hunters Association. They're kind of held what they would call gun dog or shooting dog stakes, pardon me. If you guys have ever heard of L. Hugh Pointers, which was a famous man named Bob Wheely, that was a famous breeder of English pointers. He kind of created the shooting dog stakes for the American Field back in the 50s and 60s, I think. And so that's still kind of a popular game. And then the AKC tends to be more popular, even with their horseback stakes, amongst kind of the continental breed owners in this country. So like the Brittany's and the Short Hairs, things like that. The Weimaraners, the Vizslas, they tend to want to mostly run in the AKC. And now there's exceptions to this rule, so don't get mad at me, anybody out there listening, that's maybe running their Vizsla in American Field or whatever. But kind of this is just a broad generalization that that's how the game's played. And they have a few walking stakes in the AKC as well. And then you have NASTRA, which is a popular game with all breeds. And then you have maybe the UKC pointing dog program, which is lagging well behind all those others in popularity, but in my opinion, it's a lot of fun. So that's what I play.
Awesome. Yeah. So you've kind of done a little bit of everything and know a little bit about everything to do with pointing dogs. And I know you mentioned earlier that you have some retrievers in your kennel too. What all is your kennel comprised of at this moment?
Well, right now, as far as client dogs are concerned, there's no retrievers. It's all pointing dogs. I got a couple of setters and mostly versatile breeds. Otherwise, I do have a Picardy Spaniel here at the moment, which is I never had a Picardy until about 6 months ago. And in the last 6 months, wow. Months, I've had three of them here. And so that's pretty cool. Mm. They're a lot interesting, but I would say they're doing a good job with consistency of – two of them were litter mates, but another one came from a different kennel, and they've all been nice, consistent dogs. Personally, I keep mostly French Brittany's. I've got a Labrador, my own lab, that's got one HRC started pass.
Heck yeah.
But she gets to go everywhere with me. I sent her with my friend Logan Sheets lives up here, and he owns Gray Light Kennels at British Labs. He's got some very nice dogs, and he'll come train with me on occasion. And he just happened to be going to a HRC test one day, and I sent her with him. And first time he had ever even touched her, he went out there and got a started pass with her. So I was proud of her for that. But she's my utility dog around the farm. She does a lot of work in training the pointing dogs. And finding our crippled birds wherever they happen to be.
What's her name again?
Althea.
Althea. You know, it's funny because me and John were talking about this episode, and one of those questions that John asked was, what breed do you think is the most versatile? And I think he went on to like stipulate Upland, but in my mind I was like, I know Grayson's gonna say his lab, because I saw you posted, you know, that dog's picked up a dove, a squirrel, a duck. What else was it? A couple of pheasant or something in there? Woodcock.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's just, she gets pulled out of the box for everything, and she's got some, you know, and I don't normally discriminate. I've had some American dogs come through the kennel that were just as cool as anything, and easy to be around, and smooth and quiet dogs. So, you know, I think it's, we all need to be careful not to get too exclusive with one being one way or one being the other. But that said, Althea's got, she's a British heritage dog, and certainly personifies that. She is the easiest dog I've ever had to be in the presence of. And she just comes in to drive and does everything I've ever asked of her. And does a really good job with it. And so she's only 2.5 years old. And she, you know, man, I use her all the time. So I'm super happy with that dog. And I do believe, you know, I mean, if I were to only own one dog, and it's not just because of Althea. I mean, if I could only have one dog for the rest of my life, it'd have to be a lab. They are unparalleled in their versatility. You know, if you really truly wanted to make a lab hunt anything, I think you could, as long as it was a well-bred dog.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I also, you saying her coming from British lines, I can't help but think about, you know, the British style field trials and what that is and what all they're hunting over there. And it is kind of the definition of versatility.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, they're fantastic dogs. And I remember I had a good friend of mine owns a kennel down in Mississippi. He's from Louisiana. He's on the border somewhere down there. But his name's Ricky Elston.
Yeah.
And he's a quiet
dog. I'm familiar with him off of Instagram. I live in Louisiana, so I'm actually, I live in the same parish as him. Okay. We call them parishes down here, not counties.
Okay. Yep. So Ricky's a real good friend of mine. He's kind of a mercurial fella, so, you know, don't hold it against me if you have words with him. But he is an amazing dog trainer. He's a great dog trainer. He's one of the hardest working people I've ever known in my life. And he told me, man, one time we were in Afghanistan together, and he said, Lab's the most versatile dog on the planet, and I don't care who says anything otherwise. And I can remember at the time, you know, I was coming out of the working dog world for the most part, and I just thought it was a silly statement. And he's proven me wrong over the years, time and time again. Every time I've needed to call on a lab for something, they get it done. If we need to make bomb dogs out of them, we can. When you look at service dogs, they're always there. I mean, they're a very popular breed for a reason.
Right.
So,
do you think you could train a lab to do Schutzhund?
Yeah, I 100% think I could take, you give me the right dog. I mean, the one thing that makes them so versatile is you've got an enormous gene pool to draw from. Do I think Althea could do well in Schutzhund? Probably not. but I can promise you, when I was at K2, a few dogs came through my hands that I could have certainly taken out there and done just fine. And, you know, I mean, Schutzhund doesn't require any real level of aggression. It requires, you know, a dog with a lot of drive, you know, and there are plenty of labs out there with that.
I'm sure they're out there, but I just think of labs as such people loving dogs. I can't really imagine I can't really imagine one running on a Schützen course, but like you said, you can force fetch a dog to pick up a bumper. Why can't you force fetch a dog to go grab somebody?
And I mean, you'd be amazed. Like, you really don't. I mean, you know, for the most part, I mean, I spent most of my time in that game, in that world, as a decoy. You know, really all you are is you're a big tug toy. You know, I mean, there's certain dogs that have some triggers and they're mean dogs and whatever, but for the most part, most of those dogs are just very, very, very high in prey, and they like to engage in a competitive manner with a decoy. They you know, it's not a fight for life and death out there for those dogs. They're just out there having a good time. You know. So yeah, you give me the right lab, I guarantee I could go out there and be competitive and shoot some with it.
I'll keep that in mind. Grayson, we really appreciate you being on this episode. I can definitely see and understand your wealth of knowledge when it comes to pointing breeds and pointing tests. And I always think it's really neat to watch pointing dogs work. So I think it's awesome how in those pointing dog tests, they really do truly let that dog work through a real life situation. And we appreciate you carving out the time to talk with us and teach us something. And we hope all of you guys listening were able to learn something from this too. Maybe you weren't going to run any trials with your pointing dog, and this might have convinced you to try it out, or maybe this even convinced you to start looking into some of those pointing and versatile dogs. And if that's the case, you know, best of luck to y'all. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, write us a nice little note in there, or give us some number of stars that you think we're deserving of. I've said it before, but that really does help us pinpoint what you guys like listening to, so we can make sure that we do a little bit more of that. We appreciate you guys hanging in for these awesome episodes, and for, you know, really watching this podcast grow from what it was when we started, you know, about 20 weeks ago or so, to where it is now is just mind blowing. You know, I was telling John the other day, I just reached out to somebody who was talking about the podcast, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I listened to that." And just kind of blew my mind. So we definitely value all you guys, and we enjoy putting out information for you guys to enjoy. So thank you guys. Thank you, Grayson, and hope you guys enjoyed this episode.